This is part one of David's December 2013 conversation with engineer and designer Carla Diana.
Welcome to the Illusion of More podcast. I'm David Newhoff. You might have heard about the brewing legal battle between toy maker Goldie Blocks and the band The Beastie Boys. If you haven't, you can check out the Illusion of More blog for commentary as well as several other sources. But regardless of all these copyright shenanigans, Goldie Blocks CEO Debbie Sterling has certainly brought the subject of women in engineering and design to the foreground. And it occurred to me that I know a really cool woman engineer designer who has smart things to say on that subject, as well as the future of technology itself, especially robotics. Carla Diana originally studied mechanical engineering, but early in her career, she shifted her focus to industrial design, which demands a broad set of disciplines that actually sound more sociological than technological. In January of 2013, Diana wrote an article for the New York Times about how we interact with robotic machines and how that interaction is anticipated by designers in the early stages of development. Most recently, Diana published a book called Leo the Maker Prince. It's a children's story meant to spark interest in the possibilities of 3D printing, and it works in conjunction with projects kids can do using a consumer-grade 3D printer. Diana also teaches at the University of Pennsylvania and School of Visual Arts in New York City. She spoke to me via Skype from her home in Manhattan. Carla, let's begin with the present. You just published Leo the Maker Prince, so tell us about it.
So Leo the Maker Prince is a children's book about the future of 3D printing. And it features a story about a robot who happens to be a 3D printer. And then the story also evolves around a bunch of that kids can also go online and download so they can print them themselves. So they can be holding the object while they're reading the book.
So if I understand you correctly, the book works in conjunction with 3D objects that children can make. Is that right?
Yes, exactly.
And of course, you've been a maker and a designer of things by trade. What made you want to write the book?
Well, I was very excited about 3D printing because I have used 3D printing for many years as a professional designer and technologist because it's certainly been around. There were machines that cost, $100,000 that I've had access to. But when I saw this desktop 3D printing movement starting to happen with companies like MakerBot and Up, and there are many 3D printing companies, I realized that this ability to create a really kind of perfectly shaped object was going to be accessible to almost anyone. And I realized that this was really going to change the way that we both design as well as potentially the way that we manufacture things. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to tell the world about this. And, when I started thinking about how I wanted to tell the world, I realized that I wanted to tell the world about it through pictures and objects. And not so many words.
So I've sort of jumped to the end or to the present day by asking you about the book, and I'd like to come back to 3D printing. But first, let me take a step back and ask you about your early career and your education and how you got this way.
Sure. How did I get this way? So I always knew I wanted to make things, create things. And I was kind of a geeky kid, good at school and good at math. And so mechanical engineering seemed like the logical choice. So I did study mechanical engineering. I worked as a mechanical engineer for a number of years. But I discovered that there was such a thing as design, or more specifically industrial design, which was also a career that involved making things, but it involved a really holistic look at the things you make and thinking about how they fit into people's lives and thinking about materials and colors and why we make the things the way they do. And it involves psychology and it involves empathy. And when I learned that there was such a profession, I realized that that's actually really what I wanted to do. So I went back to school and I went to a place called Cranbrook Academy of Art, which was the very opposite of going to engineering school, because it's a very conceptual place and it's very focused on art design and architecture. And the time that I was at Cranbrook was the late 90s, and that's when image of the internet the way we have it today was just starting to emerge. So in addition to really starting to think about materials and physical things, I also became very seduced by the digital world. And when I finished that degree, then from there have been just a host of opportunities, some software and some in physical objects, and I've always been looking for the way to bring those two things together. And we're finally at this kind of critical moment in time where those things are coming together, where we have a digital, just take 3D printing. We have a digital file that becomes a physical object, but can still exist as a digital file and be changed. We have, objects that have light and sound and movement that are very much controlled by programming and by databases and all that kind of stuff. So that's kind of where I got to where I am today, which is that my focus is really on what I might call smart objects, or some people are calling it the Internet of Things.
And what you were just saying there about a holistic approach to design reminds me of the article you wrote in January of this year that appeared in the New York Times. And it was about our evolving relationship with technology, in particular, how we do now and will probably in the future interact with objects. In the article, you discussed working on a design for a robotic vacuum. And I found it interesting that you mentioned that even for that object, it sounded as though you have to really become a student of human nature, if I've got that right. And because what you're describing there is not only how the object will respond to the human, but also how the human will respond back to the object. Is that an accurate way to put it?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And I mean, I think you really hit the nail on the head that a lot of the focus of my work and what I see design becoming is really understanding human nature and then crafting the things around us so that they exist in this conversation with us, you know, rather than us having to learn this sort of foreign thing. I mean, for years we've had to learn, the mouse. Like, we take for granted that we know how to use a mouse, but that's actually a pretty foreign thing. We have to force ourselves to learn. We have to learn commands to type into a computer. And, that's not an ideal way to do things from a designer's point of view. And what I think about is, like, even a vacuum cleaner is now going to have robotics inside of it. It might be autonomous and able to move around on the floor. It needs to communicate with you to let you know that something needs to be replaced or something is stuck or some task is complete. And, in order to have that machine communicate those things, what I really try to do is break it down into human language. So what are the human phrases that vacuum cleaner might say if it were talking to you? I mean, think about all the ways that the vacuum cleaner can communicate. So communicate through light, it can communicate through sound, it can even communicate through the movement and do a little dance or something like that. And, what are the things that we intuitively recognize as humans in terms of what those gestures might mean to us, and then really harness that?
You know, it's interesting. Just yesterday, my assistant and I were reading this article about this new app, I think it's new, called the Us Plus app. What it is essentially is a computer-based NAG. It's designed to work in conjunction with video chat, right? So you're chatting with somebody online, but with, you know, through video. And what it does is it will pop up little hints, suggestions, or admonishments as you are talking and tell you when your behavior is inappropriate. For example, it'll say you're talking about yourself too much, or you're going on too much. And it's interesting, and I suppose we can make fun of it. You know, the creators of the app see it, or at least from what we read briefly, see it as sort of a social experiment, which makes sense. But it does beg the question, things like this beg the question as to, you know, how much we want to allow technology to sort of invade our lives in this way. And I imagine the reason I bring it up is I suspect that that inherent tension is exactly what you deal with in your work every day. Is that right?
Yeah, no, I think that's true. And I mean, what's interesting to me is that seems to be one of the questions that comes up the most, and one of the things that's the most provocative about this area of work. You know, when I give talks, one of the questions I often get is, you know, well, shouldn't we be afraid that those machines are going to start to control us if they know how to communicate with us in a way to manipulate our emotions? You know, isn't this a bad thing, and shouldn't we be afraid, and all this kind of stuff? And I do think to some extent, you know, manufacturers want us to buy more stuff, and we will be manipulated as we have been through many other medium.
Right. You actually addressed that in the Times article. You do offer a couple of warnings. And if I can summarize, I think what you're getting at is this sort of distinction between interaction and manipulation. In fact, you began that article writing that you were, I think, yourself surprised at your own response to a robot called Simon. And, you know, what that made me think about is that, you know, here you are, a technologist and an expert in designing this kind of technology. You're having this reaction. And then toward the end of the article, you address this sort of notion of manipulation or the potential. And it is what you are sort of warning about, right? That one of the things we have to be concerned about with this sort of smart object development is the potential that these things can be used to manipulate behaviors that maybe we don't want, to make us eat the wrong things or buy things we don't really want.
Right. Or, you know, in with the Us Plus app that you're mentioning, it's something that we choose to insert into our lives to manipulate us because we want to change our behavior in some way. So there's a lot of dialogue about behavior change that's going on in the design community as well. And, you know, I just think that this is inevitable and it's a part of our near future. So we have to embrace it. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's, you know, one of the things that's exciting and challenging about being a designer is that, you know, you are now kind of responsible for thinking about these decisions and, you know, in some ways making an ethical choice.
That was going to be my next question, Carla.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I was going to ask whether or not you think technologists have that responsibility, you know, as you're designing new things or designing improvements on existing things. Do you feel that technologists have the responsibility to consider the larger implications of the things you're making, either socially, practically, philosophically? Do you feel that sense of responsibility?
I think that we absolutely do have that responsibility, although we don't necessarily have the power. Mm. You know, I think that technologists should really think about, like, this is fundamentally wrong, and this is going to essentially hurt people, whether it's hurting them psychologically or physically. You know, but the power really rests in the hands of the big companies and manufacturers who are enabling the project. Because, you know, truth be told, if I don't work on it, someone else will.
And that was going to be my next question. You know, if you read my blog, you know that I'm a bit of a cynic, or at least that I like to kick the tires on the digital age, as it were. And, you know, it seems to me that in the economic times in which we live, particularly watching the tech sector, watching Silicon Valley, it's hard not to get a sense sometimes that we're watching Las Vegas. In other words, that, you know, you look at a small company, like maybe the one you just work for, or even your own, and it's almost as though for some, the brass ring, if you will, is not necessarily to develop something that'll last a century and go on and create lots of jobs for, you know, thousands of people for decades. But the goal is to just get bought out as quickly as possible by one of the giant companies. And then, you know, whatever they're going to do with the technology, they do, and the small company gets an absolute fortune and goes off and lives on an island or maybe makes something new. Not only is there a bit of an economic problem in this, if this is what's happening, but I also see, from based on what you just said, unless I misunderstand you, there's a bit of a technological/social problem, right? In the sense that, you know, the social decisions that'll be made relative to the technology that, say, the big company just bought out will then just be made by the big companies that, you know, these that will have a very small set of large companies making these kind of decisions.
I do think that's true. I think what you've described is somewhat true. I think it's truer for younger people who have not lived as long. I mean, I actually have a lot of colleagues and a lot of peers who are really interested in doing something meaningful. And I think that we're far from it. I think we're in a very primitive stage in a sense. And that primitive stage is like, yeah, we just want to make something and make money. But I'm an optimist and a utopianist, if that is a word. I really do see a lot more dialogue around people wanting to do their thing. Because you wind up devoting your life to a startup, you know, whether it's for a number of years or for your whole life. And I think it's got to be something that you believe in. In a really fundamental way. And so, you know, one of the companies that I've been a little obsessed with is called Paper by 53. And it's, and they start out, the first product that they put out, it was an app that's called Paper. Okay. And it's a drawing app. And there are plenty of other drawing apps out there, but something about their app really captures the joy of drawing. They kind of capture what it's like to use a watercolor brush. They capture this really delightful moment in mixing paints, and you know. And now they've been expanding to a service where you can actually print out the book that you've drawn on your app. And then, you know, recently they've launched a stylus, and it's a stylus that's like incredibly well considered, and it's a real pleasure to hold and to use, and it's got some added features, like it communicates via Bluetooth in order to be pressure sensitive and things like that. And well, you know, what I'm sort of impressed with is that, at least from my point of view as an outsider, what I see there is not a company looking to make a lot of money. What I see there is a company that loves drawing. And I see a bunch of people who have devoted their lives, at least for the time being, to drawing, to owning this, the experience of drawing, and to bringing the joy of drawing to other people. And, you know, so I would like to think that that's the reason that startups do what they do. But I know that it's not.
And I don't mean to generalize. I know that there are a lot of very interesting startups out there, and there are a lot of different kinds of entrepreneurs, different kinds of technologists. And I don't mean to suggest for a minute that a company should not make money. Of course, it has to. It's just, I think it's a question of how, you know, what is the strategy, whether you're trying to build something versus just sort of cash in, as it were. But without going down that road too far, let me ask you this. What, as a technologist, you know, looking sort of at the future and thinking about where we are now, what would you say is the best approach versus the worst approach we could do? What do you think is important for people in your field to be thinking about right now?
I think that the best thing that we can do from both sides of the table is be thoughtful. And, you know, as a designer, you know, be thoughtful about the projects that you choose to be, to actually curate your career. Right. I think that there are just so many opportunities now, more than ever before, mm-hmm. that we can kind of choose. And I think that, you know, the other thing that is happening right now, and I think what a lot of our conversation has been revolving around, is that because of digital tools, it is easier than ever to actually start a company and put together a prototype and, you know, produce some small run of something and then use a crowdfunding platform to, you know, fund it and distribute it. And I think that, you know, the best thing that we can do is, again, be thoughtful about what that is and not be creating something because we want to make money, or we think it's, and I think that, you know, and I say that because I think that that has been pretty much what has made the world go around up until this moment. You know, is you create a company in order to make money for yourself and hopefully for others because you're creating jobs. Mm-hmm. And I think that now, with the ability to produce so much stuff, and with this like new kind of focus on the physical object through this kind of Internet of Things and the smart objects, that you know, just producing the stuff is not enough. It has to be, at least tries to make our lives better and tries to be doing something that the people working on really believe in.
And maybe you just answered this, but can you give me an example of anything, you know, like a mandate, if you will, that you give yourself in terms of being thoughtful?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm almost at a point in my career where I keep seeing opportunities emerging around kids and toys and learning and that kind of thing. And I feel like that's very exciting to me. And I always ask myself the question, well, where is the learning? So if I'm working on like a electronic musical toy, is the child just generating predetermined music, or is the child actually learning something about musical structure? And you know, to that level of granularity. And, you know, and then also, so I teach these smart objects courses. I teach at the University of Pennsylvania, and I teach at School of Visual Arts. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of the first course of its kind in both institutions. And it's really my area of passion. And, you know, one of the key benchmarks that I make the students try to measure their projects against when they're just coming up with concepts is what I call better than analog. So if they come up with a smart object, like, oh yeah, it's like a scissors and it has a chip in it, and you know how many times you cut the piece of paper, you know, I ask them, well, what's the analog? So that's an absurd example, but that's
my No, it's funny though. Like, I get you.
So, you know, I ask them, I say, okay, so there's your concept. Now, you have to prove to me that it's better than analog. Like, what would be the analog equivalent of that? Like, well, you know, I could just count the times I've cut the piece, or I could look at the piece of paper and see the number of times that I've cut it, and that would actually be something that all of us, if I shared this process with someone else, they would also see it, and they wouldn't need my scissor. Or, you know, so I think that that's, I think that with this explosion of smart objects, that that's a very critical question. Is it better than analog?